Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
All right, let's open the box, get out the instruction card, and don't lose the pieces, because if you do, we're going to have to find replacements around the house for us to use. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And today, for Free for All Friday, I want to talk about board games, those classic board games that we played as kids growing up, that we still introduce to our kids today, the secret rules behind them, the fun retro TV commercials that went with them. Today is a day to go down nostalgia lane and talk about the secret world of board games. And I'm going to restrict myself to those classic board games that people grew up with, as well as some other games that I found interesting that I didn't play myself, but something that I've come across that I definitely want to share with you. So there are those classic board games that we grew up with, and I think a lot of us started on those and then migrated to the more mature games, the better games. For example, I always had friends, and this might be a heresy to alert to some of my listeners, growing up in high school, especially college and after college, I had friends who always wanted me to play Settlers of Catan with them. They always like, Trent, you want to play Settlers of Catan with us? And I never put in the time to really learn the rules. And so I was like, nah, I don't really feel like doing that right now. All I know is you trade this for sheep. And, you know, I look at the box and it's hard. When I want to play a game, I want to just know, okay, are the instructions here on a card that I can read and figure out in a few minutes? I have a really hard time. I don't like it when I go somewhere and people say, you want to play this new game with us? Sure. How do you play? And then the response is, well, it's kind of hard to explain. So why don't you just start playing and you'll figure it out along the way as we do it. Okay. All right, let's start. Okay, well, I'm going to do this. Oh, no. You can't actually do that. No. Why don't you do this and then we'll come back around to your turn later. I'm like, this is actually not enjoyable or fun at all. So I never graduated to kind of the more advanced games like Settlers of Catan or Pandemic or all, you know, so there are more advanced board games. Then there's also card games that have gone along with that. I do like some of these card games. My mom was really nice to me a few years back, bought me and Laura's like a birthday gift, a series of card games you can play that you can actually pick them up really quickly. There's one, I think it's called Bang is what it's called. So they're not like playing cards. They're not like gin rummy. They're more like animated cards or comics, little comics on the cards that tell you what to do and how to battle other players. And so that stuff is fun. But I want to focus on today, though, are the classic board games that we grow up with. So let's give it a shot. Let's start with one that you've probably, I remember this is probably the first board game I ever played. And I bet it was one of the first board games that you ever played, and that is Chutes and Ladders. So Chutes and Ladders, here's an old commercial from 1983 for the game Chutes and Ladders. It does a pretty good job of summarizing it because there is not much to Chutes and Ladders. So let's listen.
Here's a game about climbing up and sliding down. It's called Chutes and Ladders. You can land on something good, like rescuing a kitten in a tree.
Ah, you're going up, up, up the ladder!
Or land on Break the Cookie Jar. First one to climb to 100 wins. Chutes and Ladders really has its ups and downs, but mostly it's lots of fun. Chutes and Ladders is a Milton Bradley game.
It has its ups and downs, but mostly it's a game of luck that is hopelessly boring for adults to play. But it's a fun game to introduce children to when you play Chutes and Ladders. So basically, there are 100 spaces on the board, and you have to go up them, and you roll just a single die, or dice, roll a single die to advance. And if you land on doing a good deed, you go up a ladder and you get higher, and the goal is the first person to get to the number 100 square. And if you just roll, you could either land on a ladder to go up, or you might land on a space that shows you doing something bad, like breaking the cookie jar, and you go down the chute, and you end up going down. So the lesson the game teaches you is, by doing good things, you advance and win and go higher, and if you do bad things, you get punished, and you go down and you go lower. Well, this idea, does it sound familiar to you? If you do good, you'll be rewarded. Bad, you'll be punished. I mean, it's kind of a universal ethic, but it also is kind of an incarnation of karma, the Hindu idea of karma. In fact, that's where the game has its origins. It's one of the oldest games in the world. And it was originally called Snakes and Ladders, not Chutes and Ladders. So instead of going down a chute or a slide, you would kind of slide down the back of a snake if you were punished that you went down the board. So the game was originally called Moksha Patam, and it was an ancient Indian board game. And so you would go up, the same thing with the ladders, but then you would go down, you'd slide down the snakes if you did something wrong. According to his Wikipedia article, the game is a simple race based on sheer luck and is popular with young children. It was acquired by Milton Bradley, however, in 1943. The ladders represented virtues. In the original game, Moksha Patam, the ladders represented virtues like generosity, faith, and humility, while the snakes represented vices like lust, anger, murder, and theft. The morality lesson of the game was that a person can attain salvation, moksha in Hindu, Hindi, I guess it would be. I don't know if that's Hindi or not, but it would have been played in India thousands of years ago. So if you could attain salvation or moksha by doing good, whereas doing evil, you will inherit rebirth to lower forms of life. The number of ladders was less than the number of snakes, as a reminder that a path of good is much more difficult to tread than a path of sins. Presumably reaching the last number, or 100, represented the attainment of moksha, or spiritual liberation. In fact, the game Chutes and Ladders actually has been incorporated into the American vernacular in the idiom back to square one. So, you know, let's say you fail at something and a whole project falls apart and you say, well, looks like we're back to square one. That's a reference to Snakes and Ladders, which was when the game was called Snakes and Ladders or Chutes and Ladders. It's the phrase, let's see, one of the earliest attestations of the phrase says, withal, he has the problem of maintaining the interest of the reader, who is always being sent back to square one in a sort of intellectual game of snakes and ladders. So when you play Chutes and Ladders, 100 is the space you want to get to. You start at space one, and some of the snakes that you end on, the chutes, could send you back to the very beginning of the game. So back to square one is actually a reference to Snakes and Ladders, which would eventually become in 1943 through Milton Bradley, the game Chutes and Ladders. When it comes to strategy, how do you win the game of Chutes and Ladders? Well, you should just try to be the player number one. A two-player game is expected to end in 47.76 moves. So if you're playing with another person Chutes and Ladders, it should be over in about 48 moves, with a 50.9% chance of winning for the first player. These calculations are based on a variant where throwing a six does not lead to an additional roll. Some people play with those rules. And where the player must roll the exact number to reach 100. If they overshoot, their counter does not move. So you can change the rules a little bit, but you have a very teensy tiny advantage of winning if you manage to go first, because obviously you're already ahead in the game when the second player starts. But Chutes and Ladders is basically a game of luck, but it is a nice one for very small children to learn the essence of rolling a die, moving their piece, and seeing what happens to them. A great game to introduce children to when it comes to board games. And then when you want children, what's funny with Chutes and Ladders is it teaches them, well, what's fair or unfair? I guess Chutes and Ladders teaches little kids, life's not fair. Things happen, and you either do good and you're rewarded, or bad and you're punished, and just deal with what happens to you in life. This crushing, cynical lesson is underscored in another classic game we were all introduced to as young children that seems to include elements of skill involved, but it's probably just a lot of luck anyways. The phantom notions of skill involved only serve to frustrate the player as you try to advance in the game. So what game am I talking about that seems like maybe you're able to win at the game, but it's mostly just luck and it's cruel in how it drives that lesson into you? Well, that would be none other than the game of Monopoly. So here is an old 1980 commercial for Monopoly. I think Parker Brothers, of course, acquired the rights to Monopoly. This is a 1980s commercial for the game Monopoly.
Parker Brothers, kind of fun, brings people together.
Delayed.
So apparently this guy is just like sitting in, I guess it's like a bus station or it doesn't look like an airport. He's sitting like in a train station and he points up at the thing that shows the trains and it says delayed. And it's like, oh no, we're being delayed for several hours. How could we kill several hours of time? Oh, there's one good game for that.
Monopoly's been bringing people together for almost 50 years. That's how long we've been wheeling and dealing together, building hotels together, and going to jail together.
Corner the market and utilities. You can't lose.
Share a smile and your day seems a whole lot better.
Parker Brothers kind of fun brings people together.
Yes, it brings them together because they close their fists around each other's necks because they're so frustrated at playing this game. Even in the commercial, when you watch the commercial for this 1980 Parker Brothers Monopoly commercial, smiles and playing together, one of them makes a face like, oh man, I can't believe we're still playing this. Because what happens when you end up playing Monopoly? What ends up happening is somebody ends up getting enough Monopolies like right at the beginning through sheer luck. And then the rest of the game is a torturous exercise where you go around and around the board and you're slowly drained of your money by the monopolist who's got control of the board, who just drives you into submission. And it takes forever to get the game done. And alas, my friends, that was the exact lesson that the inventor of Monopoly was trying to get across to us. So this game actually was created by an anti-monopolist. It's not a celebration of business. Mr. Moneybags, Uncle Moneybags, whatever his name is, Mr. Moneybags is not a hero. He's essentially a villain to the person who originally invented Monopoly. The Monopoly can be traced back to 1903 when American anti-monopolist Lizzie Maggi created a game which she hoped would explain the single tax theory of Henry George. It was intended as an educational tool to illustrate the negative aspects of concentrating land in private monopoly. She just got a patent in 1904. Her game, The Landlord's Game, was self-published beginning in 1906. Maggi created two sets of rules, an anti-monopolist set in which all were rewarded when wealth was created, and a monopolist set in which the goal was to create monopolies and crush opponents. According to an advertisement placed in the Christian Science Monitor, Charles Todd of Philadelphia recalled the day in 1932 when his childhood friend Esther Jones and her husband Charles Darrow came to their house for dinner. After the meal, the Todds introduced Darrow to the landlord's game, which they then played several times. The game was entirely new to Darrow, and he asked the Todds for a written set of the rules. After that night, Darrow went on to utilize this and distribute the game himself as Monopoly. Because of this act, the Todds refused to speak to Darrow ever again. Parker Brothers bought the game's copyrights from Darrow, and when the company learned Darrow was not the sole inventor of the game, they split the profits evenly with Lizzie Maggi. Just kidding. Didn't Monopoly teach you that corporations are evil? What really happened was, when the company learned Darrow was not the sole inventor of the game, it bought the rights to Maggi's patent for $500. So, I mean, at least they bought the patent. They bought it from her. Maybe she was vastly undersold and it was a bad deal, but she sold it nonetheless. So the game was created to get people to understand what's bad about Monopolies. And I agree, actually, Monopolies are bad. We touch on economics a little bit. No, obviously, we touch on economics a lot in my book, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? No, Here's Why, co-authored with Catherine Pakalik. But we don't do an entire treatise on Catholic economics. That'd be an entirely different project to undergo. But I feel like a lot of the criticisms, we do answer an argument that capitalism is bad, therefore you should be a socialist. And we show, nope, that is not the case at all. Capitalism can be reformed. Socialism cannot be. It's an intrinsically bad thing because it violates the right to private property. It undermines the family. It violates the Catholic principle of subsidiarity. So just because capitalism has warts on it and has unsavory aspects, mostly due to capitalists, it was William F. Buckley who said, the problem with capitalism is capitalists. The problem with socialism is socialism. So when you look at it in that way, yes, of course, capitalism is going to have its flaws. But many of the flaws of capitalism that I have seen, frankly, are what is called crony capitalism. This happens when government uses its vast resources and ability to tax to divert its funds to particular private corporations and keep them in business when the market would have already driven them out. And so you have congressmen getting expensive contracts with particular companies, spending government money on overinflated goods. You know, the idea like in the Navy, they spend like $900 to install a toilet seat or something like that. So I think a lot of times monopolies can really only exist in a free market when they're propped up through laws that prohibit competition, for example. So, yeah, I actually agree. I would agree with Maggie that monopolies are a bad thing. You should allow the market to have free competition to prevent people from having an undue stranglehold over the market. And so I agree with that, but, you know, not with the not with an entire anti-capitalist message you might find in something like monopoly, because capitalism is a tool human beings have discovered. It's a tool that can be used for good or evil, but is a tool nonetheless that has lifted more people out of poverty than any other tool created in the history of the world. You want more on that? Check out my new book, co-authored with Catherine Bacolic. Can a Catholic be a socialist? The answer is no. Here's why. Another fun trivia fact about Monopoly is that a version of it was created for prisoners of war. We talked about this in a previous episode about bicycle playing cards, that there were some bicycle playing cards that when you would smuggle them in or people would deliver them to soldiers, if they were sent in the, you know, in the camps, these prison camps, and the soldiers were given a deck of playing cards, the guards would think, oh, it's just playing cards. What's the big deal? But inside the playing card, when you got them wet, you could unfold it. The glue would come apart, and there were secret maps hidden inside to help them find their way if they escaped from the prison camp. And so something similar was created for prisoners of war with instructions on like the chance card and other items hidden in the game, including real money hidden in the game to help them when they would escape from these prison camps, all hidden in the Monopoly game. Also, when it comes to Monopoly, here are the rules you may not know about, okay? So these are the official rules of the game. Most of us, when we grew up, did not play by the exact official rules, but here they are you may not have known about. First, chance cards are mandatory. Some people say you don't have to take what's on a chance card. No, you do, because it's chance. That's what happens in life. And if you land on chance and you pick it up, you go to jail, you gotta go. That's just what happens. Free parking does nothing. The free parking space does nothing. A lot of people thought that when you collected the fines, you could pool them in the center and people who landed on free parking got them. No, free parking doesn't do anything. You don't have to do a lap first before you can buy property. You can buy property immediately when you get off the go. If you land on go, because normally if you pass go, you collect $200. If you land on go, some people say you get double money. That's not in the rules. You get the property of a player that you bankrupt, and properties are put up for auction if you don't buy them. So if a property is not bought, if you say, well, I'm not going to buy it, then the property goes up for auction, and then people can bid on the property itself, which makes the game actually a lot more interesting. And you still get rent when you're in jail. So sometimes staying in jail can be one of the safest things that you can do. Like you try to roll dice to get out of jail. Staying in jail can be helpful because you still collect rent while you're in jail because you're an evil monopolist conspiring with the government. So you still get your rent even while you were in jail. And the strategy when it comes to winning Monopoly is just being the most persistent person who doesn't care about other people's feelings. Just kidding, but it is kind of true. According to most websites, if you can get all four of the railroads, that's one of your best starting points. Revenues from railroads are much more constant over time. It's a good return on investment. Owning 3 to 4 railroads really is a cash cow. Also, when it comes to building houses, you should try to build houses on the orange color group, St. James Place, Tennessee Avenue, New York Avenue, or 3 houses on the light blue, Oriental, Vermont, and Connecticut. Because when you start out the game, these properties are fairly inexpensive, so it's easy to buy them, and it's easy to get houses on them quickly. Because once you get the houses up, you can start pulling in some serious cash off of them. So you want to build up and early. So your best bet is the light blue, Oriental, Vermont, Connecticut, or the orange, St. James, Tennessee, and New York. And remember, if you play the official rules, if no one buys a property, you can bid on it and do what you can to bid to get those properties early. All right, the next one, another cruel game to teach you that life is really just about cruel, blind fate and no one actually cares about you is Milton Bradley's The Game of Life. Let's play that commercial.
Be a winner at the game of life. Find a job.
I'm a doctor.
Have money, maybe.
Get married.
Have money, maybe.
Have a baby.
I got twins.
Take a chance.
Game of life.
Stuck. I inherited a skunk farm.
Be a winner at the game of life.
I'm a millionaire.
Be a winner at the game of life.
From Milton Bradley.
Be a winner at the game of life, as long as you land on the right chance spaces to make your life go well. And you remembered to go to college at the beginning, but you weren't stuck with crushing student loan debt. That's probably in what they're going to, in the remake of The Game of Life today. So The Game of Life, also known simply as Life, is a board game originally created in 1860 by Milton Bradley as the checkered game of life. The Game of Life was America's first popular parlor game. And the game simulates a person's travels through his or her life from college to retirement. Variations of the game accommodate up to 10 players. The modern version was published 100 years later. So it was the checkered Game of Life in 1860. The version you and I play with the spinner and all the like the fancy stuff on it, that was created in 1960. So Bradley came up with the idea for the Game of Life back in the middle part of the 19th century when his other economic venture failed. He created a lithograph to duplicate prints of Abraham Lincoln for people to have in their homes. But the problem was Bradley had a lithograph of a clean shaven Abraham Lincoln, and nobody wanted to buy the prints of Abraham Lincoln without a beard anymore after he started sporting a beard and looking quite fancy in it. So then the Game of Life proceeded from there. It was copyrighted by Milton Bradley Company in 1963, and then it would have differences with some of the later versions. So, I mean, there's a description here online that goes on to talk about that. But I remember just playing the Game of Life, always trying to get to be the millionaire tycoon at the end. Like, I'm going to be the millionaire at the end. I'm going to make it. And you spin the spinner. And that little plastic spinner was always so chintzy. Like, you could never get it to go around right. Or you would spin it so fast, it would, like, fly off of the thing. And you weren't able to get it to go well. But if you remember, by the way, if you remember playing any of these games, do leave a comment at trendhornpodcast.com. If you are a subscriber for as little as $5 a month, you get access to bonus content and you get to be part of our community to talk about these episodes with one another. Go check that out at trendhornpodcast.com. So that is the secret origins of the Game of Life. The next one is the Game of Risk. Now, the Game of Risk, so far the games we've talked about, these classic board games, have been mostly games of chance. Risk is primarily a strategy game. There is a fair amount of chance involved in the Game of Risk, but there's a lot of strategy involved. So it's definitely something where if you are skilled and you know what you're doing, you have a great advantage over other amateur players. So the Game of Risk was invented by the French film director Albert Lamoisi. Albert Lamoisi, originally released in 1957 as La Conquête du Monde, The Conquest of the World, and I apologize to our French listeners as I butcher that. It was bought by Parker Brothers and released in 1959 with some modifications to the rules as Risk, the Continental Game, then as Risk, the Game of Global Domination. Risk is a strategy board game of diplomacy, conflict, and conquest for 2 to 6 players. The standard version is played on a board depicting a political map of Earth divided into 42 territories, which are grouped into 6 continents. Turn rotates among players who control armies of playing pieces with which they attempt to capture territories from other players, with results determined by dice rolls. Players may form and dissolve alliances during the course of the game. The goal of the game is to occupy every territory on the board, and in doing so, eliminate the other players. The game can be lengthy, requiring several hours to multiple days to finish. I remember this was a big one in high school. There was a group of friends that I had, and we would get together at night, and people were always inviting us like to go to these high school parties, and we would say, no, I do not have time to go to Susie Q's big high school party. This wasn't the 1950s or anything like that, but I'm just picking a name out of thin air. No, I don't have time to go to the popular kids varsity athlete party. Okay, I'm sorry, we cannot be there. We are going to be at Will's house playing the game of Risk until 2 a.m, all right? Or there may not have been such invitations, and instead we were just playing the game of Risk until 2 or 3 a.m, or when we would get to have nights spent at other friends' houses, it was great. We'd stay up until 3 or 4 a.m. and pass out, and we just played Risk. And yes, that game could go on and on forever. How it works, you begin the game, you have these little pieces, they're your armies, and you put each one down on a territory on the board, and you claim each territory one by one. And your goal as you put the pieces down is to keep people from getting a whole continent. If somebody gets a whole continent, and then they can replenish their armies, they can get a lot more armies every turn and grow and advance their pieces. So you always put your pieces down, and you pick one per territory, but then eventually you can amass pieces so you have a lot of armies in a single territory. And then you invade other territories through dice roll. You would roll a dice. There's a attacking dice and defending dice. And the way it worked was that the defender always had a slight advantage. They just had to match you, which is true in real life that when you attack a country, the defender always has a slight advantage over the attacker. And so that was a lesson, of course, that the British learned in the Revolutionary War and a lesson we learned in the Vietnam War. So you would play this, and the goal was to try to get an entire continent and have a place where you could strategically attack other people but still replenish your armies. According to Wikipedia, holding continents is the most common way to increase reinforcements. Players often attempt to gain control of Australia early in the game, since Australia is the only continent that can be successfully defended by heavily fortifying one country, either Siam or Indonesia. I totally remember this. I was a Siam contingent all the way. I would always try to get Australia, and then I put all of my armies down on Siam, and I'm like, come at me, come and get me, yo. I've got 20 armies in Siam. You got nothing. It's the only way to get to Australia. I'm going to get two armies every turn, yo. And then somebody thought ahead and they got North America and they got like eight armies every turn. I'm like, maybe I didn't think this all the way through. Okay. So I don't know who I'm trying to imitate with that voice, but I apologize for anyone who is offended by that. If you are justly offended. Let's see here. When it comes to access points, you would always try to get a continent that didn't have a lot of access points. Australia only had one. South America only had two. The bigger ones, like if you controlled Asia, you got a ton of armies, but Asia was almost impossible to defend because it had 5 access points where troops could enter. So it took a lot to try to do your best in the game of Risk, and it could take forever. And there's a funny episode of the television show Seinfeld, where Kramer and Newman, hello Newman, are playing the game of Risk, and they have to keep the board at Jerry's apartment because they're worried about each person tampering with the board. And Kramer and Newman get really out of hand as they're playing the game of Risk. And finally, they are on the subway finishing their game of Risk. They took the board with them. It has all the little pieces perfectly lined up. And you got to get the pieces all in the right place. And they're on the subway, and Kramer is about to crush Newman, basically, in the game of Risk. And here's how the scene plays out in typical Seinfeld fashion.
I'm sure you know where the impound yard is?
Oh, stop stalling. Come on.
I can't think. It's all this noise.
Or is it because I've built a stronghold around Greenland? I've driven you out of Western Europe? And I've left you teetering on the brink of complete annihilation.
I'm not beaten yet. I still have armies in the Ukraine.
The Ukraine. You know what the Ukraine is? It's a sitting duck. A road apple, Newman. The Ukraine is weak. It's feeble. I think it's time to put the hurt on the Ukraine.
I come from Ukraine. You not say Ukraine weak.
Yeah, well, we're playing a game here, pal.
Ukraine has came to you. How about I take your little Boris?
So then they're on the subway and the random Ukrainian guy hears them. He's like, you say Ukraine is weak? How about I smash your board, huh? And then their game is over in typical Seinfeld fashion. All right, here's the last game. This is one, as I said, it was not a game that I grew up with. Well, it's a game that people all around the world grew up with, but is much more common in East Asia, Philippines. It's basically the Asian version of chess, and that is the game Go. So Go is like chess taken to like the 8 millionth power. Go is an abstract strategy board game for 2 players in which the aim is to surround more territory than the opponent. The game was invented in China more than 2,500 years ago and is believed to be the oldest board game continuously played to the present day. Take that, chutes and ladders. A 2016 survey by the International Go Federation's 75 member nations found that there are over 46 million people worldwide who know how to play Go, and over 20 million current players, the majority of whom live in East Asia. Despite its relatively simple rules, Go is very complex. Compared to chess, Go has a larger board with more scope for play and longer games. So the idea behind Go is that you have a white piece and a black piece, so it's like chess, and you set them down on a board, and you try to take over as much territory as you can on the board, and by taking over territory, you can remove pieces, and you each piece has to touch another piece as you do it. So it's a territory acquisition game, a lot of variables that are involved. And as I said, it's extremely complex. And it was so complex that a big benchmark for artificial intelligence was the question, could a computer be taught to play Go? I mean, computers have been taught to play chess for a long time. Computers can now beat chess champions. There was that famous match where Garry Kasparov played Deep Blue. I remember that as a kid when that was on the news. It was a big deal. But people thought, well, you could do that with chess, but Go is way more complicated. How could that be? So DeepMind Technologies, which was later acquired by Google, developed a computer program called AlphaGo in its quest to beat a world champion Go player, which would be the category being a nine don, it's kind of like a grandmaster in chess, the nine don. And so this documentary, you can see, my wife and I watched it on Netflix. Awesome documentary. I highly recommend AlphaGo. There's one scene where there's a lower tier, like a three or four don player who gets beaten by the AlphaGo program. And his wife says to him, I told him, don't go on the internet. They say mean things about you. Don't go on internet today. And so because after he gets beaten, people are like, how could you lose to that machine? And the guy's like, I did the best that I could. And then the machine goes to play Lee Sedol, who is at the time the world champion in Go and Nine Don, and to see if the machine could beat him in a 5-round game. So here is the trailer for AlphaGo for you to get an idea of it.
Go is the world's oldest continuously played board game. It is one of the simplest and also most abstract.
Beating a professional player at Go is a long-standing challenge of artificial intelligence.
Everything we've ever tried in AI just falls over when you try the game of Go.
The number of possible configurations of the board is more than the number of atoms in the universe.
AlphaGo found a way to learn how to play Go.
So far, AlphaGo has beaten every challenge we've given it, but we won't know its true strength until we play somebody who is at the top of the world, like Lee Sedol.
A match like no other is about to get underway in South Korea.
Lee Sedol is to Go what Roger Federer is to tennis.
Just the very thought of a machine playing a human is inherently intriguing.
The place is a madhouse.
Welcome to the DeepMind Challenge. The whole world is watching.
Can Lee Sedol find AlphaGo's weakness?
Ooh.
Whoa. Is there, in fact, a weakness?
The game kind of turned on its axis.
Well, look at his face.
That is not a confident face.
It's developing into a very, very dangerous fight.
Ooh, hold the phone. Lee has left the room.
In the end, it is about pride.
I think there's something went wrong.
Yeah, it's man tech.
It's got to be a miracle.
These ideas that are driving AlphaGo are going to drive our future.
This is it, folks.
And so the movie, its climax is when Lee Sedol plays the AlphaGo at the game, and they play a 5-round match. Oh, now I'm thinking here, you know what? I'm going to spoil it. If you want to watch the documentary and be surprised at what happens, just turn the podcast off now and go and watch AlphaGo. Very cool, because we're basically at the end of the show. But if you're like, I'm not going to watch a documentary, Trent, just tell me. Fine, then I will tell you. AlphaGo beats Lee Sedol 4-1. So what's funny is, as you watch the documentary, even like the people who make AlphaGo, people are like, can a human win? Like, it's scary. It's scary to think like these computers can do everything better than we can. And it's like people are all rooting for him, and people like crying that he beat the game. He beat the computer at least in one round, that he was able to do that and exploit its weakness in a move that it made. But ultimately, the game still crushed him nonetheless. So I was reading a cartoon. It was some kind of a cartoon or comic afterwards talking about what games humans can beat computers at. And right now, the only two left that we can successfully beat a computer at, the only things we can beat them at, are 7 Minutes in Heaven and Calvin Ball. Of course, because Calvin Ball doesn't have any rules at all, which is something humans are great at adapting to. So definitely check that out, AlphaGo. And then I'll have to leave some of the resources for you at trendhornpodcast.com. So thank you all for listening. Hope you enjoyed today's Free For All Friday. Get out there, have a leisurely weekend, pick up a board game, and enjoy spending some time with friends and family. And if you're playing Monopoly, just try to be a decent human being to the other person that you're playing with. All right, don't drag on their inevitable defeat like some cruel, wealthy, capitalist monopolist. In any case, thank you guys so much. Hope you have a blessed day and a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.